Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things that we can do for people and a planet. My name's Kevin Fulton. I'm a professor at the University of Florida, one of your top 10 public universities. That's pretty cool. Well, today's podcast, we're going to talk with students, graduate students who have an interest in science, of course, but also an interest in sharing that science. I was approached by Dr. Sarah Evangia. And Sarah, you may recognize as the director of the Cornell Alliance for Science. And the Cornell Alliance for Science is an organization that was established at Cornell University, an effort that was created to increase the literacy about food insecurity and opportunity all over the world. There's a big emphasis on genetics, particularly some emphasis on biotechnology and the way that biotechnology may be deployed to solve specific issues in food security. Cornell is very active, or at least the Alliance for Science is very active, and I suppose Cornell is too, but the Alliance for Science is very active in recruiting and training students in science communication. And what you're hearing today is three interviews, which were done by students, Andrew Katz, Bliss Betson, and Sarah Kuze. The three students participated in a workshop in San Diego right before the plant-animal genome meetings. The students then were able to practice what they had learned in these boot camps or in these workshops. I always kind of weird calling it a boot camp, but a workshop. By participating here on the podcast. So Sarah reached out to me and Paul Vincelli and asked, would you be willing to interview these students to let them get some practice in talking about the work? And of course, Paul and I were very happy to oblige. So what you'll hear today are three young scholars talking about their particular projects. And what's important to notice is their enthusiasm for the science, but also their enthusiasm for communicating the science. And I don't think that they're alone. I think the next generation of scientists have a very different opinion on what it means to be a scientist. It's not just about what you do in the lab, the papers you create, the grants that you earn. It's about how you share the science you do with a public that desperately needs to understand it. Enjoy today's podcast. And today we'll start out the podcast by talking to Andrew Katz. Now, Andrew Katz is a student at Colorado State University. Andrew, where are you in your current education?
I'm just starting my fourth semester as a graduate student with Dr. Stephen Pierce, and we work on wheat genetics.
Okay, and in the wheat genetics area, you have a rather challenging research question that you've taken on. What is the problem that you're trying to solve?
The problem that we're trying to solve is this question of actually applying all of the great, wonderful biotech tools that have been generated over the last, say, half century, specifically utilizing CRISPR-Cas9 technology to validate some of our hypotheses in the wheat genome. One of the biggest challenges in wheat, for those that don't know, is wheat is a hexaploid species, means that there's six genomes within each cell. There's 21 chromosomes, and it's we call it the A, B, and D genome, which represent three different subgenomes. I hope that's enough information.
Where did the C genome go?
That's a great question. We're not super sure. There's a lot of different progenitors, some wild relatives of wheat, per se, and we kind of order things in the way we discover them, and so the hybridizations of the A and the B and the D genome were called as such. And I'm actually not quite sure where the C genome went.
It's kind of like batteries. Oh, no, we have C batteries. We don't have B batteries. Yeah, well, anyway, we're going off topic. So what exactly are you studying, and you know, what is the major barrier towards the research that you're trying to resolve?
The major barrier that I'm trying to figure out is how to get CRISPR-Cas9 into the wheat cell to do the genome editing. And so in some species like Arabidopsis, you can just dip the flour into some agrobacterium. In rice, you can throw some seeds on some tissue culture and create callus. In wheat, it's what we call a recalcitrant crop. It's very difficult and to work with in a tissue culture form that we can then use to apply biotechnology tools. And so what I've dived into is trying to screen and optimize different tissue culture techniques so that we can take some of these improved varieties of wheat, that is actually grown by farmers in Colorado, and try to figure out how can we apply biotechnology, or if it's even possible to apply biotechnology to these improved varieties.
And so the idea is that you're able to regenerate the wheat, as we always say. And tissue culture, for those listeners who don't know a lot about this, it's kind of like a weird black art. I mean, it's as much art as it is science. You're trying to take a single cell and turn it into a group of cells that then can eventually give rise to the whole new plant, which means if you can get your construct, as we say, or the CRISPR-Cas9 gene into that, or Cas9 gene into that first cell, you can now generate a plant from that one cell where all of them share the same genetics. But it can be a challenging thing, particularly in monocots. And wheat, of course, is a monocot, which is has some other genomic issues. Have people been able to successfully transform wheat with any regularity?
Yes. There is Bob White, I guess, would be the white lab rat of the wheat world. It's our model species. And it's actually fairly efficient in transformation when you compare it to wheat as a whole, as a species. Now, it's kind of an anomaly when you look at wheat at large, and there's a very large difference in ability to transform wheat when you look at different varieties. If you look at one variety to another, it can vary greatly in how easily they are transformed.
And are you doing what are you doing that's different to try to get that transformation rate to increase?
So what I have really tried is, I guess we'll have to go back to my past a little bit. I was originally trained in monocot transformation in the species Brachypodium distachyon, which is a model grass species. And we use a tissue culture method where we take small embryos from before the seeds mature. We take the embryos and we put them on a media with sugar and hormones. And using the hormones, we trick the plant into dividing and creating like an embryonic callus piece. I kind of use the analogy. It's kind of like plant stem cells. Not exactly, but I think a lot of people have an idea of what stem cells are. And so once you have this tissue, you can then divide it into many pieces, and then you change the formulation of the plant hormones, and you can get single plantlets that are derived from single cells. And so in the wheat world, a lot of people are still using technology where we skip that callus step, where we go from an embryo, we transform the embryo, and then we regenerate the plant from that embryo. And what's difficult about that in terms of efficiency is that, you know, you have one shot at it. You have one embryo, and if that embryo doesn't regenerate due to the technical difficulty of the situation, then you've reduced your likelihood. So if you take the embryo and make the callus from one embryo, you can make 100 callus, or if you wait a couple months, you can get 1,000 callus. They grow exponentially. And then you've increased your opportunity, your chances of success by a lot.
Well, sure. Plus, when you transform just that one embryo, are you getting a mosaic?
You can most definitely get a mosaic. People do use culturing methods to try to avoid that, but that is definitely a concern.
So when you're doing your work, are you doing something a little bit different? Maybe something that other people have not thought about or have not applied?
Well, right now we're really in the screening screening portion, and that's where the novelty lies right now. We're trying genotypes that weren't around before when previous wheat tissue culture was being performed. And we're really just trying to figure out, like you said before, it's just as much an art, a black art of tissue culture. And, you hear stories of how people had, it was only this one, one corner of the lab that you could possibly tissue culture this variety. So we're definitely still in the beginnings and trying to figure out just what are the genotypes, the varieties that perform best and take it one step at a time.
Your points are not lost on me. I'm a tissue culture guy too, and I can transform stuff and get regeneration where nobody else can do it. And I can show people how to do it, and they go in the lab and it doesn't work, and I go, well, of course it works, watch, and then I do it. But there are people in my lab who've done very well with it, but others just could never get it to go. So what do you have, a whole series of genes, a candidate genes that you're ready to try to transform as soon as you get the system going?
We're getting there. So we are working. I'm a part of a team at the Pierce Lab. We work very closely with our wheat breeder at CSU, and they obviously they already have a lot of populations. They do things like genomic wide association studies. They have very interesting populations that are segregating for interesting phenotypes. So there's a lot in the pipeline. But unfortunately, the CRISPR revolution, as some may say, has kind of really opened up a sore wound, which is the limitations of plant tissue culture and plant transformation. And so there's a lot of pressure right now to develop these techniques, become efficient in these techniques so that we can address this backlog of CRISPR genes, targets, and validation and basic research that will really be enabled by better tissue culture methods.
And so what is your long-term plan? Like, say, once you graduate and get out of Colorado State, do you plan to stay in a tissue culture-related field or maybe in gene editing overall?
I do have a very strong passion for tissue culture and gene editing. There's really nothing like holding a transformed plant in your hand. I'm sure you have that feeling. It's a plant that, you worked really hard, you designed really well, and you finally, after many months of effort, have a living thing in your hand. It's quite a feeling. I'm still very early in my graduate studies, and I'm still testing out different things, such as where I want to end up as a career. But I'm very open to working in tissue culture for quite some time.
Well, right now you're at the science communication camp and really working on honing your skills in science communication. And could you tell me a little bit about your experience there, and maybe how that can be part of what you do going forward?
Oh yeah. No, most definitely. It is it's quite interesting. So one of the activities that we had to do, we're in beautiful San Diego right before the Plant and Animal Genomics Conference. And so one of the activities is where we went out and addressed the public and to find out what the public knows about CRISPR and genome editing. And it was quite a, at first I was very nervous. It was kind of scary going up to strangers on the boardwalk and asking them if they had an opinion about genome editing. It was quite thrilling. And I think that as I move forward in my career, it's important to get out of your comfort zone. And we often, as scientists, talk to other scientists and have a community of scientists that we interact with. But there's plenty more people out here, and everyone's life is impacted by biotechnology. And so it's important to open up and have those conversations and not be afraid of speaking to the public.
Now they're desperately trying to figure out who they can trust. And unfortunately, we haven't been in that space. And it's great that you're doing this. If people wanted to learn more about what you do or maybe follow you online, are you present in social media like on Twitter or Instagram?
Oh, unfortunately, I'm not. That is, it's an area that I'm actively trying to get better at. We do have a lab website. You can find us at Colorado State University at the Pierce Lab. That should be a fairly easy Google search, and you can find my work there.
Yeah, you have to be careful. If you Google the Pierce Lab in Fort Collins, it takes you to a tattoo studio.
Oh, does it? No, there are plenty of tattoo studios in Fort Collins.
No, it's the other kind of Pierce.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd throw that out there. I'm having fun today. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time on this today. Good luck in all your studies and reach out if we can ever be of assistance. Maybe you should co-host a podcast sometime. So reach out if we can ever help you out.
Thank you very much for your time.
This is Paul Vincelli, occasional guest host on the Talking Biotech podcast. On this segment, we're going to speak with an MS candidate, a Master of Science candidate from Kansas State University. Her name is Bliss Betson. And welcome to the Talking Biotech podcast, Bliss.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
So I know that this particular disease that you're working with is really regarded as one of the most important threats to food security and food production in countries that rely on wheat. So I'm going to give you a chance to explain a little bit about this. Tell us about the work what issue are you seeking to address, and give us some background.
Of course. So the fungal gene, or excuse me, I'm just going to not say that.
Okay.
So the rust that I'm working with, it's a wheat stem rust, and it is identified as the UG99 race group. It was originally founded in Uganda in 1999. And so basically it has evaded a lot of the current resistance genes put in place for wheat stem rust. And currently, throughout the past years that it has been identified, plant breeders, geneticists, plant pathologists, and that kind of community have been working to identify new resistance genes that can be put in place to battle this pathogen, and they have been successful. So there are several genes that have been identified for adult plant resistance to this pathogen, and I am particularly looking at one of the resistance genes that was founded to combat UG99. And I'm basically studying the pathosystem of SR35 and its copart, which is AVR-SR35, and then the variants that go along with AVR-SR35.
Okay, so AVR-SR35, that's, all right, so let me just be sure I understand here. So SR35 is a gene in wheat that confers resistance to wheat stem rust. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So then what is AVR-SR35? That's another code you stated, but help us understand, what does that stand for?
Of course. So SR is a term for stem rust.
Okay.
And then AVR is a term used for avirulence. So it's an avirulence factor, a protein that has been in the fungal pathogen itself.
Okay. And so why is that important from the standpoint of knowing what that does?
Of course. So basically these two proteins act together as a gene-for-gene interaction. And whenever they interact together, this creates a hypersensitive response. So whenever the pathogen infects the wheat plant, SR35 recognizes this AVR-SR35 of the fungi to create a hypersensitive response, which basically consists of localized cell death. And it basically cuts off all resources for this fungal growth.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, that's a good explanation. And so I think about, the hypersensitive response. It's a phrase that we know in plant pathology and use a lot. And basically, what I understand that to be is it's kind of like a suicide of a few cells of the plant that it sacrifices in order to, or as part of its arresting the growth of the wheat stem rust fungus.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Right. So what is your how does your research relate to this? Basically, before I move on, another thought that occurred to me is it's you're basically studying this sort of interplay of molecules between the parasite and the host to either successfully invade the host or for the host to successfully resist the infection. Is that a good, okay.
Yes, that's right.
So what is it you are doing and with a little more depth now that we've sort of framed it for our audience, what is the work you're doing with respect to SR35 and this interplay?
Right. Well, as I stated before, UG99, it has evolved and it continues to evolve. So something that my advisor likes to state is that pathogens never sleep. This fungi never sleeps. And it has the ability to evolve past resistance genes that are set in place to combat this pathogen. And so whenever I look at the natural variants, the natural evolution of this pathogen, I have taken 10 of the natural variants that are found in nature, which were collected from Africa and the Middle East, and I basically test them against SR35 to kind of visualize the viability of SR35 as a resistance gene that is put into place right now. And so how I like to kind of explain this is that I'm Bliss, and then I also have my siblings. I come from a very large family. Mm-hmm. And so, Paul, you know me as Bliss. If I came up to you, we had this interaction. We're making this podcast together. But if my sister came in the room and started talking to you about something, you wouldn't know who she was. And so basically that's the same way as this reaction between the resistance gene and the avirulence gene and all of its variants. So I could be AVR-SR35 and you could be SR35. And then my sister could be a variant of myself. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of the same genetics, but we are not the same, and you do not recognize her.
Right.
So that's kind of like what I am doing within my research. And basically what I'm trying to figure out is what is the core necessity for resistance? What nucleotides, what sequence is specifically required for that interaction to take place?
Okay. Boy, that's good. I like that. That's a very nice analogy. I've been working for, my entire career, kind of beginning really in the mid-80s in graduate school, trying to find ways to convey the science of plant pathology to different audiences. And I think you've come up with a very nice way to explain the evolution and the generation of variants of a parasite that might allow it to overcome resistance genes. That's very good.
Thank you.
So what you're doing is you're trying to understand basically the ongoing evolution of this parasite, the UG99's wheat stem rust parasite,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So its whole race group. Yeah. I'm trying to identify those things. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. How far along are you in your work? I mean, are you?
So far, I guess I can go a little bit more into detail about that. So far, I have tested these variants that I have in place. And then I've come up with a few potential candidates. So initial testing was done using the tobacco assay infiltration method. And so basically with wheat stem rust, the leaf surface area is not very large. Mm-hmm. And so you're not able to see the hypersensitive response in an effective way. So basically you transform the genes that you're working with and co-infiltrate them with agrobacterium into tobacco to visualize this hypersensitive response, the cell death that you're looking for. And if you have susceptibility, you won't see this hypersensitive response. But if you have resistance, you will see that hypersensitive response. And so basically that was our initial method of recognition. And then from there, we're doing RT-PCR and qPCR to kind of validate that research a little bit more. And that's pretty much where I'm at right now. In addition to this, I would also like to do a little bit more for the community of people who are working with UG99 race group by creating tools to help identify new resistance genes so that they can effectively be put into place. And then also I am collaborating with some people in the USDA and other people at Kansas State University to kind of sequence a reference genome for Rust.
Yeah, very good. So you're using tobacco as basically a plant model to allow you to test whether a particular variant of the wheat stem rust fungus might be, to test whether that might be able to infect a new resistance gene or overcome a resistance gene. Have I described that properly, or is there a better way to describe that?
I think there's a better way to describe it. So like I was saying with SR35, I'm only working with the SR35 pathosystem. Mm-hmm. So I basically pin two genes together. So whenever I'm taking my genes that I'm working with, I order the sequence from a company.
The DNA sequence, sorry.
What? Yes. Okay. So I order that as an oligonucleotide sequence from a company. I transform them into E. coli, grow them up, and then I transform E. coli into Agrobacterium. And so I have my resistance gene, SR35, in an Agrobacterium.
Okay.
And then I also have all of my variants transformed into Agrobacterium as well.
So you're working with the one gene from wheat, SR35. And carry on, sir.
Also all of the variants as well.
And all the variants. Okay.
So yeah, so I do a co-infiltration into tobacco. So I mix my SR35 with each one of my variants in turn and infiltrate into tobacco. And this is a method that has been used in the past and is pretty reliable. As it shows visually a great representation of effective hypersensitive response in plants.
Mm-hmm. So it's a way to kind of speed up the screening process to see if your SR35 will recognize a new invading parasite, one of the variants you're working with.
Yes, that's right.
Yay, I got it. Okay, good. So, so one of the things you mentioned in one of your previous interviews, I've done a little homework to prepare. You talked about synthetic duplicates of the UG99 race. So you're actually not working with live cultures of UG99, and I think you may have mentioned the possible risks to our own crop, right, to here in the United States. So it makes sense that you would. What is, in terms that our listeners will understand, what is a synthetic duplicate? I actually had not heard of this until I saw it in this article.
So yeah, I actually already mentioned it previously in this podcast, but I'm talking about the oligonucleotides that I'm ordering from the companies. So I already have the sequence references for each of these variants. And so instead of having the rust for all of these variants, I just have the sequence and I order those sequences from the company so that I can manipulate them into this system for tobacco assay infiltration. So I'm actually not specifically working with the rust that can be put out into nature or anything like that. But if I were, then I would have to work in a different kind of facility that had a lot of biosecurity within that facility, because like I stated earlier, this fungal infection, this disease is only in Africa and the Middle East as of right now.
Right. And as I know you mentioned earlier, it's most wheat varieties would not have resistance to the UG99 or I guess related strains. Is that?
Yeah. It's roughly 90% of the wheat varieties grown worldwide are susceptible to UG99.
Okay. So what can you tell our audience as far as looking forward? What do you, even not necessarily speculative information, but what do you anticipate, where do you anticipate this work might go just give us something to look forward with.
So I, as a master's student, I'm very proud of this research. It's basically going towards improving a mechanistic understanding of UG99 and its pathosystems and how that's working. And I think this is really important research for discovering new resistance genes. And I'm most excited about providing these tools that I've stated to help kind of identify new resistance genes and help geneticists and breeders and plant pathologists in this kind of aspect moving forward. Yeah. To put more resistance genes in place. Like, I'm going to reiterate that not only does this pathogen never sleep, but it's a worldwide problem for every plant pathologist. It seems like there's always new evolving pathogens out there that are always affecting not only the agricultural community, but I think it's something that anybody from like maybe a medical standpoint can also agree with.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point to sort of wrap this up with, you know, is the fact that really pathogens potentially never stop evolving to overcome whatever resistance the plant puts up in its way, or that we may try to take advantage of as humans. You know, we're trying to take advantage of those resistance genes that we might find, and the pathogen never stops evolving to overcome those resistance genes, and therefore we can't stop either.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, good. Bliss, thanks for your time. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us on the Talking Biotech podcast. And with that, I'm going to pass on the baton to Dr. Folta.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
A pleasure.
Now, in this portion of the Talking Biotech podcast, we'll talk to Sarah Kuze, who's a graduate student at UC Davis in the Dukovsky Lab. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Wonderful to be on here.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about the problem that you're looking to solve. Another question here in wheat.
Well, I guess the larger problem that everybody in the world is trying to tackle, whether you're working on wheat or rice or corn, is yield. And on a national collaborative level and through many international collaborations, the Dukovsky Lab and many other labs were collaborating together to basically dissect yield, a many gene trait, into single genes. And so for my project, just like Andrew, we're working on trying to basically find one of these single genes that are really important to yield and trying to understand it, clone it, and maybe even incorporate it into a breeding program.
And so the gene that you've been working on, or you've been led to, was identified by using what we call QTL analysis. But the genes that you're looking at have to do with spikelet number. And what is a spikelet?
A spikelet is really an attachment point along an ear of wheat. So when you look at an ear of wheat, many people see kind of like a braid. And each node on there is actually a position where there are between one and three flowers, and each one of those flowers can become seeds. So if you have 20 spikelets, you could have potentially 20 times 3, 60 seeds.
Okay, so spikelet number is directly related to yield, because if you have more spikelets, you have more yield, right? Is that where we're going?
Yes.
Okay, and so what exactly have you learned in your research?
Well, it's an interesting process, because you first start out with this trait, this characteristic that you look at on the physical plant, and then you're trying to identify where in the genome is correlated, or where the gene is that is responsible for that trait. And so I guess the mapping part is kind of like you're starting at a Google Map level. You're starting at maybe the global level. The global level is the genome. Then you figure out which nation or which chromosome is associated with your trait. And then you go down to the state level. And now I'm at, so to speak, the county and the street level of trying to figure out exactly which part of the genome is or which gene in the genome is responsible for my trait.
But since you have a at least you have a roadmap, which is really cool because the wheat genome has been sequenced. So since you know just kind of the streets in the county, do you have some candidates that you think are especially promising?
Yeah, so I've narrowed down my entire candidate region, or my region where I know my gene is in, to about 25 candidate genes. And the way I know that there are approximately 25 in there is because we've done what we call an exome capture analysis. So we, through previous studies, know that we have a sequenced genome, and we know approximately what part of the genome has genes in it. And I can just look at that region and kind of count how many I have left.
Oh, I see. So that's pretty cool. So do you think that you'll be able to get to it by the time you're done with your graduate career?
Well, in theory, since I have two of within those 25, you know, you can look at the characteristics of each one and kind of hedge your bets which one is the best one and which one is less likely. I should have figured out which gene is causing my trait within the next 6 months.
And so once you know which gene it is, what do you do next?
Well, that's just really the beginning. There are many ways to check which gene is responsible for the trait. There are three traditional methods, and to make sure your work is valid, you use at least two of them. The first one I'm already pursuing is we have a Tilling database, so we have a mutant database of plants that have mutations that are sequenced. And so I know I now have two mutants that have stop codon mutations in this candidate gene, meaning that in theory, this gene is turned off or broken. And I want to see if I have a broken version of this gene, does it change the number of spikelets per spike? This would be really strong evidence that this gene is the causal gene for spikelets per spike. The other method, which Andy talked about, is using CRISPR-Cas. Our lab is still working on that protocol. Andy has a lot more experience with CRISPR, and our lab doesn't. So we're choosing the agrobacterium route. So I actually went into another wheat species called Monococcum, and I found my candidate gene there, and I made a copy of it, and I put it into another species of wheat called Kronos. It's like a red wheat, and I want to see if this new version of the gene will change spikelets per spike.
Well, along that same line, you have a very wide natural variation in the number of spikelets. If you look at your candidate genes in those lines that vary for number of spikelets, do you see some sort of consistent trend that maybe ones that have low numbers of spikelets have some sort of variation in the expression of a gene, or maybe even in the sequence of that gene, that may give you hints as to where to start looking for the functional candidate?
Well, that as well. The challenge, though, with these, because I can't say exactly what my candidate gene is, because that would be problematic for my future publication. But so it's really hard because I really want to say what it is all the time. But the interesting thing is because a lot of the traits kind of monitoring or controlling like the core of flowering, very, very minute levels at the early spike development stage where this spike is at tinier than a sliver of a fingernail. At that level is when this gene is very active, and to accurately measure that and to, you know, collect tissue and measure the changes in expression is really hard to assess. So I'm pulling off that experiment right now, but it's a really hard thing to measure, and there's not a lot of existing data on that specific gene that I'm working on.
Yeah, so no way through it except for through it, right? So what do you plan to do after you're done with your graduate career?
Well, I actually want to leave academia, and I want to be a science communicator. I feel like I'm not doing a very good job on this particular interview for my science communication. But my main passion is working with farmers. I'm a lead student breeder for an organic project. I was a lead student pepper breeder, and my main passion is mentoring students in plant breeding and teaching people about genetics. I love to run an institute where it's a mentorship-based training and leadership, and so where people can learn about science and try to incorporate science into their life as a way of thinking and not just a field of study.
No, that's really good. And we need more of that. And I'm glad to hear you doing that. And anytime we can be of assistance here, let us know. I mean, you can come co-host the podcast with me sometime, you know, pick out someone you'd like to talk to and let's do it. Cause I think it's a great medium to be able to use any kind of media we can produce to help get out those messages. So, you know, that's, so you're welcome anytime. If people wanted to learn more about you or your program, are you present on social media anywhere?
I'm present on LinkedIn, but I do have quite a few kind of short articles that I've published, and I'm planning on trying to get more active on Twitter.
So if you would like to send me the URLs to those articles, I'll put them on the website that accompanies this particular episode so people can start to find you there. And when you get on Twitter, send that information forward, and I'll put that there as well.
And thank you for listening to the podcast today, and I hope you find this episode as enlightening and exciting as I do, as the next generation of scientists really is excited to share the work they do and explain it in cohesive and very clear ways. If we can get more people involved in talking about the science we do, I think it changes a lot. Because there's not a scientist out there that doesn't complain about poor funding rates, a lack of resources and opportunities, or the frustrations of seeing their best work literally die on the vine and never get into the field or into the hands of somebody who desperately needs it. You know, that developing world farmer that could use that technology to overcome a challenge with weather or insects or disease. So this is where it starts. It starts by our next generation of scientists training in how to talk about what they do in ways that make big impacts. So thanks, Andrew, Bliss, and Sarah. Best wishes going forward, because this is the next generation of science. My name is Kevin Folta. Thank you very much for listening. I know that you have many, many choices with respect to podcasts, and really do appreciate your continued listenership and support. We are starting to grow again, which is really exciting. It says that continued good delivery of a reasonable product. I don't go out on a limb. I sure sell it, don't I? Good delivery of a reasonable product. I think it's something good, and it's my passion and something I enjoy every week. So thank you for your reviews. Thank you for sharing this with somebody you think needs to hear it. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.